in these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. My heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, ah, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org, and at iTunes on Talk Radio, News Talk. I think you can find it on iTunes, KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing has everything to do with the writing and publishing of books. And today is Wednesday, July 8th, 2010, and my guests are Novella Carpenter and John Irving. First up is Novella Carpenter. A child of back-to-the-land hippies, Novella Carpenter grew up in Idaho and Washington State and attended the University of Washington in Seattle, where she majored in biology and English. She studied under Michael Pollan at Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism for 2 years, and her journalistic work reflects her interests in farming, food, the environment, and culture. She's been cultivating the city for over 10 years now, starting with a few chickens, some bees, until she had a full-blown farm near downtown Oakland. The paperback of her memoir, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, was published by Penguin in June. Welcome, Novella.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Talk about the genesis of Farm City, if you would, how the book came about.
Well, what happened was I had been farming and writing a lot of fiction, actually, when I lived in Seattle. And I slowly started to migrate toward nonfiction because you could actually make some money doing that. I wrote for The Stranger, which was an alternative weekly in Seattle, doing book reviews and that kind of thing. And then when I moved to Oakland, California, I continued to be an urban farmer, growing vegetables and raising bees and chickens and that kind of thing. Started raising turkeys, kind of fueled by Michael Pollan's writings. And then when I was working at a nursery, a plant nursery in Berkeley, California, Michael Pollan walked in. And this was before Omnivores. He had just written Botany of Desire and Second Nature, his previous books. And, you know, I started talking to him, and I was like, why are you here? You know, don't you live in New York? He's like, yeah, I started teaching here at the journalism school. And I had never even heard of the journalism school or even thought about going to journalism school. And so all of a sudden I had this idea planted in my brain that I should go and work hopefully with Michael Pollan and learn how to write like he does. And so that did happen. I went to school. And it's funny because when I was in class, you know, I would be working on different stories, and I never even thought to write about being an urban farmer, to write personal essays or that kind of thing, until Michael told me, you know, he's like, why don't you write, you know, you have a great voice, why don't you write about your experiences, you know, raising this turkey and, you know, other things. And so that's where I got the inspiration.
Interesting. I talk about first lines on this show, and the first line of Farm City drew me right in. It goes, I have a farm on a dead-end street in a ghetto.
Yeah.
It has everything you want a first line to have. And is this how the book originally began?
No, I think I was trying to be more poetic. I was trying to be more, you know, have some scene that, you know, was evocative of these things, and instead of being voicey and just saying it. And my boyfriend, Bill Jacobs, he is an avid reader, and he's like, why don't you just say it? Why don't you just say what it is that we're getting into? And I was like, oh, you're a genius, of course. You know, it's funny because it's often hard to get distance from your work, and so having a reader like Bill is so helpful.
So did that come after you had a draft, or when did that come? Did that come in the revision process?
Yeah, that came in the revision process. That came in at the point where, you know, I hadn't delivered the manuscript yet to Penguin, and I was really struggling with it. Or I had sent draft, you know, because it was my first book, I was really worried. So I had sent chunks of the book to the editor there, Janie Fleming. And then had gotten feedback from her, but you know how it is now in publishing, you hardly get any feedback. And so I was kind of struggling with the voice and sort of how to set this up. I had written, of course, like most writers, had written way too much information. And so I was culling stuff, and that was proving to be difficult. And I had yet to find a through line. I couldn't find a place where, that kind of held the book together. You know, it's one of those really frustrating things. And then I started to interject this voice, you know, that just comes in and says things like how they are. You know, it's one of those things you never know how to write a book until you have to write a book. And it's just, you know, I had written, I think the longest thing I'd ever written was a long New Yorker style piece that was about, I think it was 6,000 words or something. And it's just intimidating, you know, it's just really, really intimidating. Such tough, so many words, you know, 100,000, 125,000 words. It's just staggering.
So did the book then begin, did it sell after you had a manuscript, or did you sell it on the basis of a proposal?
I sold it on the basis of a proposal. So what happened is, while I was at the journalism school, I started submitting essays, personal essays about my farm to salon.com. And so I wrote essays about my Thanksgiving turkey and about bees, being a beekeeper in the city. And providing lettuce for the former Black Panther Party members. And so those essays were, you know, the bulk of the proposal. You know, of course, the proposal is mostly these sample chapters. And originally it was conceived as kind of a book of essays. So each chunk would be about a different animal or experience, you know. So it was very different in proposal form. And then I got an agent because she had read my essays in Salon and thought there was a book there. And I'd worked in publishing before, so I was kind of ready to. I had, you know, thought about book ideas, and I knew I had a book idea. And so I submitted the proposal right after I graduated from journalism school, and then went to New York and met a bunch of editors and then sold it to Penguin.
That, you make a great case for writers starting small, you know, getting things published in prominent places like Salon, and learning about publishing, because it seems like one of the downsides to new writers, one thing they don't know often is the business of writing. It's like one thing to write, it's another thing to, you know, get your stuff seen and have people see you.
Yeah, it's huge, and that was really useful. I mean, it was useful in terms of the writing, but, you know, just because writing an entire book would be so daunting. But it was also useful in that, you know, when you go to meet publishers, editors, then they feel like, oh, she has what they call the platform, you know.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So she, yeah, and then they feel like, oh, well, you know, if you write for Salon, then they'll probably review it. Although I don't think they ever did. that didn't work out. You know, so that's that sense of, you know, that you're building something, and that you're thinking of the book after it's been published, because a lot of writers think, oh yeah, I just stick it out there and then I have this, you know, I have a published book. Well, no, you do more work after the book's published, trying to promote it and get people excited about it and getting people to actually read it. It could be a great book, but they're not necessarily going to read it. There are so many books out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to hear you read to us.
Oh, sure.
Do that. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Novella Carpenter. Her book is Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, published by Penguin.
Okay. Okay, so do you have any preferences about what I read?
Do you want to start at the beginning?
Oh, sure, yeah.
That'd be great.
I have a farm on a dead-end street in the ghetto. My back stairs are dotted with chicken turds. Bales of straw come undone in the parking area next to my apartment. I harvest lettuce in an abandoned lot. I wake in the morning to the sounds of farm animals mingled with my neighbor's blaring car alarm. I didn't always call this place a farm. That didn't happen until the spring of 2005, when a very special package was delivered to my apartment and changed everything. I remember standing on my deck, waiting for it. While scanning the horizon for the postal jeep, I checked the health of my bee colony. Honey bees buzzed in and out of the hive, their hind legs loaded down with yellow pollen. I caught a whiff of their honey-making on the breeze, mixed with the exhaust from the nearby freeway. I could see the highway, heavy with traffic, from the deck. I noticed that three bees had fallen into a watering can. As their wings sent out desperate ripples along the water, I broke off a twig from a potted star jasmine and offered it to the drowning insects. One bee clambered onto the stick and clung to it as I transported her to the top of the hive. The next bee did the same. She held fast to the twig like a passenger gone overboard, clutching a lifesaver. Safe atop the hive, the two soggy bees opened their wings to the morning sunlight. Once dry and warm, they would be able to fly again. Just to see what would happen, I lifted the final rescuee to the entrance of the hive instead of the top. A guard bee stomped out from the dark recesses of the brood box. There's always one on vigil for disturbances, armed and ready to sting. As the guard bee got closer to the wet one, I braced myself for a brutal natural history lesson. The waterlogged bee started to right herself as she waved a soggy antenna. Another guard bee joined the first, and together they probed the wet bee. She couldn't have smelled of their hive anymore, which is how most bees recognize one another. Nonetheless, the guards began to lick her dry. "Hey, hey," a voice yelled. I peered down the end of our dead-end street. A new car, a silver Toyota Corolla, had arrived on 28th Street the night before, probably the victim of a joyride. Corollas are notoriously easy to start without a key. Local teenagers steal them and drive them around until they run out of gas. Already the car had lost one wheel. By nightfall, I predicted it would be stripped completely. Amid the jumble of abandoned cars and trash, the shiny Toyota Corolla, I made out the figure of a man who was yelling. He waved vigorously, "Bobby." "Morning, sir," I called and saluted him. He saluted back. Bobby lived in an immobilized car. He switched on his television, which was mounted on top of one of the abandoned cars. A yellow extension cord snaked from the teal-colored house at the end of the block. The perky noise of Regis and Kathy Lee joined the sound of the nearby traffic and the clattering trundle of the San Francisco Bay Area's subway, BART, which runs above ground next to the highway. Just then, a monk came out of the Buddhist monastery across the street from my house and brought Bobby a snack. The monks will feed anyone who is hungry. Next to the fountain in their courtyard, there's a giant alabaster statue of a placid-faced lady riding a dragon, Kuan Yin, the goddess of compassion. My bees love to drink from the lotus flower-filled fountain. I often watch their golden bodies zoom across 28th Street at the same height as the power lines, then swoop down behind the temple's red iron gates. The monk who handed Bobby a container of rice and vegetables was female, dressed in pale purple robes, her head shaved. Bobby took the food and shoved it into a microwave plugged in next to the television set. Nuked his breakfast. I heard the clattering sound of a shopping cart, can scrounger. Wearing a giant Chinese wicker hat and rubber gloves and carrying a pair of tongs, she opened our recycling bin and started fishing around for cans. She muttered to herself in Chinese, "Aiya." I watched as Bobby jogged over to her. I've never seen him run before. "Get out of here," he growled. His territory. She shook her head as if to say she didn't understand and continued fishing. Bobby butted her with his belly. "I said get," he yelled. She scurried away, pulling her cart after her. Bobby watched her retreat. Then, as she was almost around the corner, as if he felt bad, Bobby put his hands to his mouth and yelled, "See you at the recycling center!" Just a few blocks away, the center paid cash by the pound for metal. Chuckling to himself, Bobby glanced up at me on the deck and flashed me a mostly toothless grin. This place, this ghetto of Oakland, California, brings out the best and worst in us. Bored of waiting around outside, I headed back into my apartment. A fly strip dangled from the ceiling, and ripped feed bags piled up near the door. A black velour couch my boyfriend and I found in the street sagged in the corner. I guess this neighborhood brings out the best and worst in me, too. Sure, my chickens lay eggs, but the flock has spawned an occasional rooster that crows loudly and often, starting at 4 a.m. Bees do result in honey and wax and better pollination, but they have also stung people from time to time. The garden, verdant cornucopia on one hand, rodent-attracting breeding ground on the other.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Gosh, we have a few minutes left, and so much to talk about.
Yeah, so much.
In just a few seconds. But I wondered about, just in terms of, you know, what made you decide on a memoir as opposed to, you know, your degree was in journalism.
Yeah.
Instead of, say, going into the direction of narrative nonfiction.
Yeah, I think what I found is that I'm just a stronger writer when I'm telling a personal story. I actually found out in journalism school I'm not that good of a journalist for some reason. And I think part of it is that I was just raised as a storyteller. My mom tells stories, and so there's this kind of thing in our blood where we like to tell stories. And I feel bad when I'm telling somebody else's story, or I don't feel as confident about it. And that's why it's just a comfort level kind of thing. And so that's what I'm left with. I mean, I wish I could be a better journalist. I wish, I could turn other people's stories into, you know, this kind of writing, but I just can't. It's too emotional. I would have to know too much about a person to write about them in this way.
Mm-hmm. And any words of wisdom for the writers listening who may be thinking of a memoir, working their way through a memoir, battling the writing of a memoir?
Yeah. Well, you know what I would say is, I mean, how I would, in some ways, I take a lot of, I'm always surprised, you know, if you look at it, I'm like a dumpster diving punk kid, you know, who published a book with a major publisher. I mean, that's that, and that they wanted to hear my story. And so I think people shouldn't shy away and kind of try to make something up that you aren't, you know, just be who you are. I mean, it's not such a cliche, but ultimately publishers are hungry for people who are real people, who have stories, unique stories to tell about their experiences. And so to not feel like, oh, I have to be, you know, a certain way for a publisher to like me. You just have to be yourself and really have a distinct voice, and so many people do.
Mm. That's great. Well, you have a great voice, and I'm just really happy this book made it out there and became a bestseller and all the rest. So
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
That was Novella Carpenter. You can find out more about her by going to her website. I believe it's novellacarpenter.com. If not, please just Google her name, Novella Carpenter, and you'll find it. Lots of good stuff there. We're going to take a short break. When we get back here, we will have John Irving with us, so please stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
And we're back. here with Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're broadcasting out of the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. We're back with John Irving. He won a National Book Award in 1980 for the novel The World According to Garp. A Prayer for Owen Meany was published in 1989. In 1992, John was inducted into the National Wrestling Hall of Fame in Stillwater, Oklahoma. In 2000, he won an Oscar for the Best Adapted Screenplay for The Cider House Rules, a film with 7 Academy Award nominations. He's here today to talk about Last Night and Twisted River, just published in paperback by Ballantine. Hi, John.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you. I've read and admired your work for years and have a whole lot to cover in our half hour together, but let's begin with Last Night and Twisted River. So curious to hear how this novel came about.
Well, I never had a novel in mind for as long as I was thinking of this one before I started it. For almost 20 years, it was somewhere in the back of my mind. That's a long time not to write something. I knew pretty much the whole story for almost that length of time. That is, I knew it was a fugitive story. I knew a father and a son have to run away, that the son has accidentally, even as a 12-year-old, killed someone, and that someone will be coming after them. The whole fugitive situation was understood to me. I knew for how many years they would be on the run, too. I even knew that that 12-year-old boy would eventually become a writer, and that this was another novel for me, my third novel, where a main character would be or would become a writer. It sounds like a lot to know, but I did not know, or I didn't have a good feeling that I knew the last sentence. And I always begin with that. I need to know not just what happens at the end of a story, but what the language is, how it's said. I need to know those last sentences, sometimes the last couple of paragraphs, and from that I seem to have the confidence to make a kind of roadmap or a plot outline of the story. And I don't really begin writing the book until I have such an outline, which always begins with that last sentence and which is complete when I know what the first sentence is, which I get to last, because the roadmap has a way of coming to me in reverse order. So this last sentence was an elusive one for a long time, but when I got it, this book had been around in my head for so long, the actual writing of the book was pretty quickly forthcoming, 3 years, which is short for me.
Interesting. So the last sentence comes, and then the last chapter? Or does the last sentence sort of give you the way to find your roadmap, as you say, and then you begin at the beginning?
Yeah, when I write a book, I begin at the beginning. But I don't write that first sentence and start the actual writing of the story until I know everything of importance that happens in the story, who the characters are, when they meet, when their paths cross again, which of them live or die, and how, and when in the story these things happen. And that all begins with knowing what has happened at the end of a story that makes this story worth telling in the first place. And if I don't know that, I don't start. So it's I don't think it's, you know, when I was a younger writer, I never would have called this a method or a process. I just thought, oh, it's just the way it happens, and maybe one day it'll change. I recognize that these first sentences, these starting moments, were indeed last sentences, that I seem to, in every case, go to the end of the story first. But I didn't necessarily, I wouldn't have said, oh, this is my method, this is my process, maybe for four or five books. And it was really only when I was beginning The Cider House Rules, the sixth novel, that I thought pretty conclusively, oh, well, you've got to pay attention to this. This is your process, because here's the sixth book, and here, once again, is an ending, that echo of the Princes of Maine, Kings of New England. That was in that last sentence, and I thought, well, you know, pay attention. This seems to be the way you want to work. And now it's such a familiar process that I even think I know where it came from, which is from those 19th century novels I read as a teenager, the ones that made me want to be a writer in the first place. They were all plotted novels, most of them long, most of them taking place over a passage of time with developed characters. And as a teenager, I think the first thing I appreciated about those 19th century novels was the plot. Before I could appreciate the language and other aspects of the craft, I could understand that this was a story written with a purpose, written intentionally, and that the plot was important. And so I think my method simply reflects that I have to know how good a story it is before I'm going to spend 3 or 5 or sometimes 7 years writing it. Mm-hmm. I have to have some confidence that, well, I know this is a good story because I know what happened.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, there are many reasons to love Last Night in Twisted River. I just loved it. And one of the things I loved about it was there's so much on the writing process. You know, Daniel, the main character, is a writer, and you go so into the writing process. I don't quite recall that from the other novels, that your other novels about writers, although I love those too, especially, I guess it was A Widow for 1 Year and The World
Yes.
According to Garp. But
those are the other two, and you're right. I mean, those novels did not reflect those characters' processes as a writer. Garp being a fourth novel, A Widow being a much more recent one. But in both cases, I didn't feel those characters were me as a writer. I felt they were writers that I knew, or they were the kind of writers I was familiar with, but I didn't think of them as being modeled on myself. Garp, as a father, as an anxious parent, was certainly modeled on that aspect of myself, but what he wrote about and the way he went about it was almost a parody of other writers I knew. In fact, some of my friends thought I was being sort of unfairly harsh on other writers by sort of making fun of Garp, but only people who knew me probably knew that. But in this case, Danny, he does have my process, and his life, his personal life, is about as opposite from mine as any characters I could imagine. I mean, Danny has a horrible life. Everyone he's afraid of losing, he will lose. Everyone he loves, either dies or leaves him. He has sort of my nightmare as a life, truly opposite my own. I've been terribly lucky, but I did give him my my process as a writer, absolutely.
Well, you know, speaking of Danny having a horrible life, you seem to farm some of the most difficult topics in your work. It seems someone is always dying, and often they are sons. And last night on Twisted River, the narrator says, Danny Angel's novels have much to do with what the writer feared might happen. How is that for you? I mean, to plumb those topics that are just so difficult to imagine.
Well, I guess in my case, a part of being entertained as a reader has a lot to do with being afraid. If I am anxious for the characters in a book I'm reading, that means I care about them. And if I trust the writer to be serious, I know that these characters aren't out of the woods. You can't read Moby Dick and not know that the Pequod and Ahab are headed for a disaster. What you don't know is that the only one left alive is going to be the guy telling you the story.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that ship is coming to no good. Well, you know, Melville used to say, woe to him who seeks to please rather than appall. And I think when I'm writing that if there isn't some aspect of the story I'm telling that frightens me, if there isn't some aspect of that story that makes me feel, oh, God, please don't let this happen to anybody I love or to me, well, then, I mean, how good is it? I sometimes know that I'm in the right territory for me as a storyteller when I'm writing about something that makes me anxious, makes me fearful. That's just something about it that essentially I really don't like. I think that's just a barometer. It is a kind of willful perversity that I imagine characters I have sympathy for and then think, okay, what's the worst thing that can happen to this person? And no, worse than that. Mm-hmm. What's the next worst thing? Worse than you think. That's the kind of... I don't feel I don't feel that's especially unique. I think I learned that from the stuff I read and the theater I saw as a young kid and as a young man. I kind of grew up in a small town theater. My mother was a prompter. I saw a lot of plays before I read any novels, and I think the theater was my first love before I read those 19th century novels that so appealed to me. I thought of being a stage actor before I thought of being a writer, and I never thought of being a playwright because plays, the writing of plays, it's not visual. The writing of novels is very visual, especially those 19th century novels, which were the models of the form for me. My models told simply, you know, horrifying stories. Dickens, Hardy, Melville, Hawthorne, And the theater I loved best was the old stuff, the Greek plays, Shakespeare, not happy stories, funny sometimes, there's even funny parts in King Lear. Hamlet is very funny, but not what happened. Not what happened. So it's, the mayor of Casterbridge, I think, still has arguably the best first chapter in an English novel. The guy gets so horribly drunk that he sells his wife and infant daughter to a sailor. How do you top that? the truth is the guy will never get over it. It doesn't matter what happens to him after that. He'll never recover from that mistake. So I think I learned it from what I read and from the theater I saw that, there was always something appealing about tragicomedy, I like both aspects of it, that it was funny and that, but that what happens is lethally serious. Mm-hmm. If you go back to 400 and 500 BC, whenever Sophocles was writing the Oedipus cycle, things can't go much more wrong than killing your father and marrying your mother and having children with her, right? I mean, that's a pretty good premise, right? And in Sophocles' case, it was good enough for three plays, not just one. Right? Well, that's a pretty good story. But it is, to use Melville's word, appalling.
Yeah. We're on with John Irving. His most recent book is Last Night in Twisted River, published by Ballantine Paperback just recently. We have a few minutes left. I wanted to, for a minute, talk about the sort of publishing industry as it is today. And one word that is forced down all writers' throats these days is platform. And I have to say, when I think of platform, I recall a long time ago, I recall seeing you in Vermont in your old Mercedes that had a license plate that said GARP. I was a student at the time at Goddard, and I recall you pulling into the post office. I didn't know who you were. I just saw this license plate that said GARP, and of course, was curious what this was. And then, of course, The World According to GARP came out, and it all made sense. Seems to me that was like the first time I ever saw platform. And, you probably had no idea that that's what that was. Anything you can say about publishing as it is today? I mean, what do you think? There's a lot of opinions about books going down the drain and others defending the idea that they won't. And all the emphasis on marketing these days for writers as well. What do you think?
Well, that's... I think it's an awkward subject for me to talk about because I feel badly for what I see as the state of American publishing. But I have to, caution any conversation about that by saying that I'm very fortunate that I do as well as I do in translation. Not every writer does. Not every American writer, especially, with the notable exception of Stephen King. I do very well in translations. And at this point, as we speak, when my 12th novel, as you said, last night in Twisted River, is just coming out in paperback. At this point, it's already been translated into 7 or 8 languages, and by the end of 2011, probably 35 or 40 languages. And I don't just have the impression, I have the information to say that in the case of the 7 foreign language countries I have visited where Twisted River has already been published, publishing in other countries is not in the kind of trouble that it strikes me, as you say, it is in the United States. And I think you have to be careful how you speculate on those reasons, or the reasons for that. It's simply true that there is a better, more embracing culture for books and for authors in many other countries than exists in the United States. It's simply true that books and authors were more important in the United States 50 years ago than they are right now. But the indifference in our culture toward writers and writing, I don't think it can be entirely laid at the feet or made the responsibility of American publishers. It's a cultural problem. I'm speaking to you from an island in off the Canadian shores of Lake Huron. I'm married to a Canadian. I live in Canada half of the time or a third of the time. I can tell you that the culture for books in Canada, little Canada population-wise, is 100 times healthier than the culture for books and authors in the United States. If you look at a bestseller list in Canada, there's much more good stuff on it than there is on a bestseller list at any given time in the United States. When I first started publishing in the late 60s, there were more literary novels on the fiction bestseller list in the U.S. than there ever are today. Now, is that the fault of publishing? Is it the fault of our culture? Is it the fault of our public education system? Yeah, you tell me. I don't know. But I just know, as an author who travels, not to all 35 or 40 foreign language countries when a book is published, but most of the European ones, Europe and little Canada isn't suffering the hard times for books that I've heard American publishers crying about for several years now. And I can't tell you exactly why that is, but I can tell you that it is. I know for a fact that it's true. I see no such evidence of that. I haven't even been to Germany for the German book tour. The book was just published in Germany. I won't go to Germany until September, right? And I'll only be there, 5 working days. I traveled for 6 weeks for the U.S. Edition of Twisted River back in the fall of 2009. I'll be in Germany for 5 days. I've already had more interviews from the German media about Twisted River than I ever had in the United States. I had more interviews in the Netherlands than I had in the United States. Okay?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
In the Netherlands. I was there 4 working days, okay? Now, you tell me what's going on, right? We, as a country, you can't blame only American publishers and what they publish for the state of the book or the relatively low status that authors have in the United States. It's true. It's just true. Mm-hmm. But you have to be careful where you point the finger, I think. I just can tell you that, I spent 4 nights, 3 working days in Barcelona. I had more media attention in Spain for last night in Twisted River than happened in the United States. That's not, that's just a fact.
Yeah.
It's been going on. It's been going on for some time.
That's really interesting.
But I know a lot of American writers don't have that perspective. I am fortunate to have this life in translation. I mean, 3/4 of my business is in translation. Right? I would simply ask your question in more broadly and say, yeah, you can question what's wrong with American publishing or what are the difficulties with and what's to blame, but more is at fault than American publishing. It's American culture that is really, really lacking.
Well, I've just so enjoyed talking with you, and I hope you'll come on with your next book. It's been too short a time to speak. And thank you though. Thank
okay.
you so much for spending the time.
Sure. Are we taped? Are we live?
What's we are live. On? We are live from Southern California.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, all right.
So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That was John Irving. His latest book is Last Night in Twisted River. Could talk to him for hours. Unfortunately, we just had a half hour. You're listening to KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And you can find out more on my website, penonfire.com. Thanks so much for listening.